The following is an encore presentation of one of many Financial Sense premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our financialsense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.
The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me on the program today is Eric Jansen. He's author of the book, The Post-Catastrophe Economy, Rebuilding America and Avoiding the Next Bubble. He's also proprietor of the popular website, itulip.com. You know, Eric, as we look at all the events of last year, Europe, issues in Asia, the fiscal cliff, all the things that were going on, despite all of these things, the stock market was up double digits. So, in your opinion, how did the doomers get 2012 wrong?
Well, if you see that article that you're referring to at the beginning of the interview that we posted in January of this year, it shows a bunch of airplanes all going up, right? So the idea is we thought that this would be the year, at least the first part of it, when quantitative easing would do its what it was designed to do. And if you listen to what Bernanke had repeatedly said in press conferences, which for some reason seemed to have didn't sink in right away, I think, with most of the analysts, is that the purpose of QE is to inflate the value of financial assets on household balance sheets. That is the stated purpose. And the theory behind it is that if you can, household balance sheets, for those Americans that hold and have actual positive net worth, most of them are financial assets, mostly bonds and stocks, and to a much lesser extent, surprisingly, housing prices. The Fed can't inflate housing prices, not directly anyway, but they can directly inflate asset prices simply by buying the underlying asset, which is a treasury bond. So by doing this, the idea in economic theory is to shift the aggregate demand curve upward, get those families out there spending money and boosting the economy. It has an indirect effect on inflation in the general economy, but a very direct impact on inflation of asset prices, and that's what we're seeing.
Well, Eric, given the fact that the markets are up double digits this year, they were up double digits last year, what are the things on the horizon that could put an end to this? In other words, what can go wrong here?
Well, the risk that everybody has their eye on and is watching like a hawk, of course, is the bond market. Not so much the bond market's reaction to inflation, but the bond market's reaction to the Fed's reaction to inflation. So there's been an uptick in 10-year inflation index bonds in the last month or so, and there's been a strong reaction in the market to what that means. Not so much the indication of inflation, which has actually been trending down, but the reaction that the Fed is likely to have, given they've had to take a very strong position to protect the bond market by saying we're all a bunch of hawks. And I think the phrase Bernanke used was, at the first sign of inflation, we can cut it off in 15 minutes, I think was the phrase he used. So this has the stock market very much on tenterhooks, that the punch bowl is about to get yanked away at any minute.
So there's been a lot of talk in the last press conference, tapering off, or the taper talk. And a lot of people were saying, well, wait a minute, the Fed announced QE3, QE4, and then almost like you remember this, Eric, about a month after they announced QE4, there was the Fed minutes that said, oh, we're thinking of cutting back. They spelled out that they were looking to get unemployment down to 6.5. Now, if you look at some of the economic numbers that have come out recently, they have not been all that good. It looks like the economy is slowing down. So people are saying, how can they be talking about cutting back when the economy is weak? Is it because they sense maybe inflation lies ahead of us?
Well, I think I've mentioned this to you before, that I'm a member of the Boston Economics Club, and we meet over at the Boston Fed. And last fall, one of the presenters was Janet Yellen, who I guess is theoretically next in line for Bernanke's job when he bails out somewhat conveniently in January 2014, which is around the time when all the Fed's models show that they should be thinking about starting to raise interest rates, not just slow down the massive accommodation through QE, but actually to tighten, to raise rates. So, you know, the position that they've taken is that they can respond very gradually in incremental steps to any signs of inflation, and that they're not going to start doing this until unemployment hits 6.5%. That assumes that their models haven't, the underlying fundamentals that are driving their models haven't changed. So they're going on the basis of their own calculation of NARU, you know, the so-called natural rate of unemployment. And the 6.5% is the unemployment rate at which they need to begin to worry about inflation. The fact is that since this process has gone on for so long now, we're 5 years into this very extraordinary accommodation, the unemployment rate, the natural rate of unemployment that might produce inflation might be higher than they think. It might be 7.5%, for example. So 6.5%, waiting for 6.5% might be waiting too long. And Volcker came out recently complaining about this, saying that, you know, his predecessor Burns made the mistake of trying to target unemployment as a way to guide monetary policy. And, of course, it turned out to be a disaster because, you know, it's really very difficult to tell what's going on underneath in terms of the aggregate demand and its impact on inflation when you're doing something as extraordinary as trying to reduce inflation, which, of course, is what the Fed has been trying to do.
What happens, Eric, and let's talk about a situation where they do begin to scale back, inflation starts to rise, the bond market reacts, and the economy isn't strong enough to for them to take off the training wheels. We go back into, let's say, a shallow recession by the end of the year. Could they come back with another dose of quantitative easing?
Yeah, I see a very lurchy process here because, again, you know, none of this has been tried before. They don't really know what's going to happen. That comes through loud and clear from looking at the various, not just the one or two or three or four different models that they're using. They try to shift monetary policy from, you know, what they pretty much anecdotal and seat of the pants to policy based. And, you know, they just don't really know. I think they're going to try a bunch of things and see what happens. I think that's part of what's going on here in their various pronouncements of approaches like tapering and so forth, and just testing the market to see what the reaction is before they actually do anything.
So it's sort of like a trial balloon. Let's see how the market reacts to this. There was some speculation that they were trying to put a brake on some of the speculation. I mean, in the bond market, people were, you know, you have institutions buying the bonds of Rwanda. It tells you a little bit how far out on the risk curve they've gone. I want to come back to the economy because despite all the things that have happened, you've seen a situation where consumers have been out there buying. Consumer confidence is, you know, maybe not at a peak, but it's been up there. You talk about, and it's something I've seen at the stores, if you want to get a consumer to buy, you got to put it on sale. And when you get used to putting things on sale, that's the only way you get them in the store. So consumers will respond. But what does this do to retailers and producers? It seems like there's a battle out there. We've seen problems at JCPenney's and some of the retailers. Obviously, if there's only a limited supply of consumer dollars because, you know, consumers are being hit with inflation at the what I call the living expense inflation level, and then they're also being hit with taxes. So let's talk about what's going on with producers and where do you see that going?
Well, Jim, part of what's happened here is that this policy of inflating asset prices to get relatively high net worth families and households out there spending money has produced a very odd bifurcated economy where you have one group of people outspending $100,000 for an electric car that goes 200 miles between 6-hour naps. That would be a Tesla, and it's really not a very practical vehicle at all. And on the other hand, you have people who are now renting tires. It's one of the fastest growing areas, retail areas, in the automotive aftermarket space. So you have some very strange things going on here with one group of folks who's really doing better and better, mostly, again, because they're feeling positive wealth effects. And then the rest of them whose incomes have been flat or declining while prices have been increasing through rises in commodity prices, particularly energy. So it's been a recovery that's been very rough, I think, on, you know, the middle income and lower households, and has largely benefited upper income households. And you see that, and getting to your question, you see that in the retail space as well.
When we take a look at this, one thing that's hitting the consumer, as you talk about, they're being hit from two sides. When you take a look at the general inflation rates, which are probably understated, they're rather low, Eric. But if you look at living expenses, maybe we don't count it in inflation. My water bill just went up because we're consuming less water, so the water authority raised rates. My cable bill has gone up. My utility bills have gone up. I've seen food prices go up. So consumers are being squeezed on that. And then on top of that, the government raises taxes, not only on producers, but they also raise the payroll tax. You know, Bernanke's gone on record that the Fed made a big mistake in 1937 by tightening too early and raising interest rates. Is the government also making a mistake if you have a fragile recovery of raising taxes?
Well, first of all, there's a bit of a misnomer in the understanding of what happened in 1937, even among Bernanke and the guys at the Fed. What actually happened then was not so much the fiscal tightening, the closing of the deficit, which happened around election time. So there was political pressure to close the fiscal gap then and too early. What really happened was unintentional tightening of monetary policy when the Treasury decided to begin to sterilize gold imports. And that had a devastating effect on the economy by shrinking the money supply. But be that as it may, clearly this Fed is not going to make the mistake of shrinking the money supply and backing off on monetary accommodation too early. I think there's been some concern, and I think too much concern, that the sequester and the so-called fiscal cliff, which turned out to be a fiscal speed bump, are going to have a really significant effect on the economy. If you look at the actual amount of federal spending that's going on, it's still enormous. It's about $1 trillion a year net of what it was before the crisis. So all this discussion about, you know, backing off spending and federal spending is really not relevant to what's actually going on, which is just an enormous amount of spending still happening.
Eric, one thing that has been posited by, you know, people like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater, is that he's betting on inflation resurfacing in the second half of the year, and as a result, he's betting on inflationary-type assets. Do you see that scenario unfolding as we go forward in the second half?
Well, we're still stuck in an output gap, right, that opened up back in 2008-2009. And, you know, this is what happened in Japan. If you can't get GDP growth up north of about 4% a year, we're just never going to get out of it. We're just below, you know, way below capacity. Unemployment is still relatively high. Consumers aren't spending as much as they would. There's not as much demand. So there really isn't a source of inflation or a mechanism to pass it through from the inputs, which are largely energy prices and commodity prices. So it kind of gets stuck there. And as you described, it just squeezes households, consumers, by increasing their costs without increasing their income. So I don't see a rising inflation this year. I do eventually see it happening, but not till later.
Let's talk about one area that impacts all consumers and even producers, and that's energy. We saw last year the IEA came out with their World Energy Outlook, and they're predicting as a result of the shale oil boom, the United States would become totally energy independent, and we'd become the world's largest producer again. You know, as well as I, that shale oil is much different than the oil that we used to, what we call conventional oil. It's more expensive to produce. The wells are more shallow. The depletion rates are much faster. What about the role that energy is playing with this economy?
It's playing a major role, and it's actually the major cause of the flattening out and then correction in gold and precious metals prices. What happened is that there's an enormous amount of investment, over $120 billion a year, starting in, you know, it took a break during the crisis, but starting earlier in the decade, around 2003-2004. So investment went way up, and then with a lag, production went up. So the U.S. began to increase its domestic production, increased by about a million barrels a day over a period of time. This reduced our oil imports, our oil import trade deficit, and very much improved our net export position. That strengthened the dollar and weakened gold because of the impact that it had on the value of reserves in central banks overseas. There wasn't as much demand to balance the currency risk that was being created by this massive inflow of oil and outflow of capital for us to maintain our domestic oil consumption. However, this is all temporary. It's not sustainable. Most of this production is uneconomical, and you can already see the very rapid drop-off in the number of wells in production as well as new ones being created. I think within 2 or 3 years, it'll be pretty clear that all we did was bring forward existing production. We didn't find any new oil, or maybe it's 80-20, 20% new oil and 80% bringing forward of oil that was already there. So we've accelerated depletion. There'll be a very rapid drop-off in production sometime down the road, and that'll have a huge impact on a reversal of this trend, big impact on oil imports, our oil trade deficit, and the dollar and gold prices.
What is it about the industry that you'll have organizations like the IEA, and Eric, you've seen this before. I'm trying to think of the potential oil field in the Gulf of Mexico where they poked a hole and they discovered oil. It was very, very deep. And all of a sudden you have these projections of vast amounts of oil reserves. The same thing is being made here with shale oil, which, one of the, I guess, more optimistic people is a gentleman by the name of Daniel Yergin, who you know of. And he's talking about an undulating plateau somewhere around 2030. I just wonder, Eric, if we've already reached that undulating plateau with all this new sources coming from shale, deep water, and even the tar sands, if we're there now.
Well, you know, I've never been as much a fan of the concept of peak oil as of the concept I came up with back in 2006 that I call peak cheap oil, which is a different way of looking at the problem. The theory is that long before the actual decline in global production, there'll be a continuous increase with some variability, so not in a straight line, but an increase in oil prices. And it's being caused by the fact that there's a differential in two rates of change. One is the quality of the oil that's left, we haven't dug up yet, is decreasing at one rate. And then the second rate is the rate at which we can improve through technology, access to new oil fields, that we can increase production. And my theory is right around the year 2000, 2001, we got on the wrong side of that differential. And the oil just keeps getting worse and harder to get at faster than we can figure out ways to get at it. So we're going to be on this wrong side of this curve forever. Whether production levels off or goes down is not as relevant as the fact that throughout this process, prices are just going to keep going up. And it's going to, in my view, tend to happen as a series of spikes. So the undulation will be, I think, an economic process more than a purely physical supply process.
Well, this also spells or has huge implications for the type of investments are made. You know, I think of a company like Boeing that's coming out with its Dreamliner. It's supposed to be more fuel efficient, but here's this big plane. I think about travel costs and hotels. In fact, we're probably seeing some of this already, where you've had some of the hotels are cutting out room service now. What are the implications of this going forward in terms of various industries? It seems to me it would impact travel. It would impact the airline industry because as these costs continue to rise, as they're doing now, it's going to get more expensive to travel.
Well, the American economy is amazingly adaptive and dynamic, and it has been responding to this for quite some time now. If you look at the average fuel mileage of our auto fleet, it's been pretty dramatically improving since the beginning of peak cheap oil in the earlier part of the last decade. And this is the way the market responds to these things. I think that it's actually going to be a boom for the preferred companies like Boeing because there'll be huge demand. You know, most of the effective response to peak cheap oil is going to be on the demand side in terms of conservation and the application of new technologies to conserve. You know, a new plane that gets 20% better fuel mileage has a huge impact on the ability of an airline to make money. And it's really quite, if you study the airlines, it's really been quite surprising how effective they've been in using things like the internet to maintain profitability, even as their fuel costs have gone up. And the way they do it is by making sure, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this, there's never an empty seat on the flight. And you could be sitting next to somebody, you could pay $100 for a seat and sit next to someone who's paid $800. And they have a way of making sure that everybody, that the market price for each of those seats gets met. So, again, I think that there's going to be a lot of different ways that the economy adapts to this, and there's going to be a lot of opportunity if you can understand what's likely to happen.
So, I mean, there's a number of books out there calling for various scenarios. One is sort of this Mad Max syndrome, and there was even a series on the History Channel sort of explaining this doomsday scenario. How do you see this unfolding? Do you think that because of innovation, because of things like, you know, whether it's electric cars, conservation, that we get through this through bumps and eventually some kind of technology or something will replace it or will adapt to it?
Well, the adaptation comes in a step function of price increases, recessions when, you know, producers come up with new products to solve the consumer's problem. We have a tremendous amount of room in conservation, particularly in transportation fuels, which is really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in peak cheap oil. You know, the average car today gets 25 miles a gallon, a new car. Now, the fleet is still pretty far behind that, but it takes about 10 years to turn the fleet over. But, you know, without much difficulty, current off-the-shelf technology will produce, you know, very, you know, fast, not slow, and clunky, about 65, 70 mile per gallon cars. So there's a lot that can happen to solve this problem over the next, you know, 10 years. I think beyond 10 years, we start to see some more, much more significant challenges, because even the application of technologies to the existing transportation infrastructure, which in this country is mostly roads, won't be sufficient to solve the problem. And that's when I think things are going to get more difficult.
So in many ways, this reminds me of a study that Robert Hirsch did on peak oil, and he said the best way to prepare for it is to make steps 20 years before it arrives. The next is 10 years before it arrives. The worst is to do nothing and it arrives. Where do you think we are, according to Hirsch?
Well, again, I think it arrived 10 years ago or more, and we're in it. It's just it's not recognized exactly for what it is, which is a dynamic of an interaction between oil prices and the credit cycle, and the way that production of oil is funded and the way that production of consumer products is funded to solve the problem that's created by the rise in oil costs. So this has been going on now for a while. The backdrop that makes this much more difficult to forecast going forward is the enormous debt overhang that has been produced by the fire economy since about 1983, which has culminated in an enormous dependency on credit and debt growth to finance economic growth. And I think that's where we're going to really run into trouble in trying to adapt it to the challenges posed by peak cheap oil, is that there won't be sufficient credit to finance a lot of the initiatives and a lot of the innovation that needs to happen to solve the problem.
So as you survey the environment today, looking around you, we've got an economy that is being held up with cheap credit. We have producers fighting for limited consumer dollars. We have the Fed talking about reducing quantitative easing. And we're doing this interview on the day the Fed is meeting. How do you see the rest of the year playing out if you were to forecast that?
I think the Fed is going to be very cautious about making any kind of sudden moves. I think the market's going to be very reactive to any indication of any kind of change in policy. I think they're going to have a couple of rough periods. But I don't see when it'll seem like, you know, we're at some kind of transition point and a real trend change. But I think those will be fake head fakes, and they won't be the real deal. I think the real deal doesn't happen until 2014, probably not until the first or second quarter, when the traditional crisis occurs in the transition from the Federal Reserve leadership from one chair to the next.
Yeah, it was interesting because over the weekend on Charlie Rose, he was asked about Bernanke, and he said, to paraphrase, he basically has extended his stay. So it looks like we're more likely to get a new Fed chairman. Now, one of the candidates is Democrat Janet Yellen, and she is known for being even more favorably disposed towards loose monetary policy than Bernanke. But in that transition period, you think we could have a lot of, let's say, market turbulence?
Well, First of all, I've met Janet Yellen, and my impression is actually that that's not the case. She's probably the only Federal Reserve governor that I've met who has expressed concern about debt levels, which is, of course, the result of all this credit creation. So you could say that she's somewhat hawkish more than dovish. I think it's interesting that she's gotten a reputation for being dovish. But be that as it may, any change in leadership in the Fed always perturbs the market, and particularly the bond market. And if you think back on the transition from Volcker in, I believe it was August of 1987, 3 months later, the stock market crashed. And now the folklore is that that had something to do with fast trading and computerized trading and all that kind of stuff. But actually, that crash started in Hong Kong and worked its way through Europe to the U.S. And it was triggered by the bond market being very concerned about what this new Fed chairman was going to do, whether he is bond friendly or not. Volcker clearly was. It was kind of harder to be more bond friendly than Volcker. So they were, you know, that was the concern. Then, if you remember the transition of Greenspan, who got out while the going was good in 2006 in January. And then we had, of course, the massive crisis a year later under Bernanke's watch. And Bernanke was brought on specifically to deal with this crisis. His whole resume was about dealing with, you know, the Great Depression and, you know, reflating an economy that was facing a debt deflation. So the next person up in the batting order seems to be Yellen, although there are others that have been discussed who would make me even more nervous, like Larry Summers, who I've also met. And, you know, I think that the markets are very likely to look at these candidates with some concern and make the calculation that the safest thing to do would be to get out and see what happens later.
Eric, any advice you would give our listeners as we end this conversation?
Be prepared for a lot of turbulence. It's going to be particularly starting in 2014. And I wish I could characterize it more specifically, but I think it's going to be somewhat chaotic because we're in a situation that has not occurred before in history. And in these cases, markets have a very difficult time trying to assess how to position themselves for a range of somewhat contradictory risks. So I think there's going to be a lot of volatility and some bouts of panic in between.
All right. Well, Eric, as we close, tell our listeners about your website, iTulip, and a little bit about your book, if you would.
Well, the book is laid out really in two parts. You know, what the problem is with the economy, and the second half is the solution. I think by now, most people understand what the problem is, that we have built an economy on cheap oil and cheap credit, and we need to transition ourselves out of that. And my proposition is that we focus on America's unique strength as a entrepreneurial engine, and just clear the path to make that part of the economy stronger.
All right. And your website?
It's www.itulip.com. We are a community of about 1,500 subscribers and 50,000 public members who discuss and work through ideas. My role is thought leadership. I do a lot of research, put ideas up there, and the crew beats it up and gets it in shape. And over time, we develop these theories that we think have a pretty good track record.
All right, Eric, listen, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Always interesting speaking with you.
Always a pleasure.
That ends the interview with Eric Jansen. I always like talking to Eric. He thinks outside the box. He's an original thinker. I began reading a lot of Eric's stuff early on, going back into the last decade. He had some interesting thoughts there, especially if you go to his website at itulip.com, read the article that I think it's free. It's Hope and Fear, the Year of Promise. It's a great article, and will give you some insight as to some of the things that we were talking about. It was rather interesting to hear him talk about, I have a theory that we're in this undulating plateau, and his theory is we've been there sort of like for the last decade or so, even though oil prices have risen from the beginning of the, let's say, 1998, when they were $10 a barrel, all the way to $150. And on the day we did this interview, they're closer to 100. And despite all the new discoveries, despite shale oil, despite the tar sands, despite deep water, and I thought his comment about, you know, the innovations that we've come up with, shale oil, hydraulic drilling, horizontal drilling, fracking, and those things have helped contribute, and we've been very innovative. But it was rather interesting because I submitted to him the Robert Hirsch scenario, which is the best way to plan for peak oil is 20 years, then 10, and then nothing. And he thinks that this began roughly about 10 years ago. And so we're in that next 10-year period. And it was interesting. He said the next 10 years, you know, we're able to keep up. The price will keep rising. But then after that, it's probably going to get a lot more difficult. And that's something that'll be interesting to watch as we go forward. His comments on Janet Yellen, I have not met her. I have read press releases that seem to indicate that she's very much in favor of a more aggressive monetary policy. I had not heard Eric's perspective that she's actually more concerned about debt, which is close to $17 trillion right now. But as in any kind of period, especially in a period where we've never been there before, especially here for the U.S., where we're dealing with 0% interest rates, we're always going to have these kind of reactions in crises. And I think his comment that next year with the change in the Fed, that should be an interesting one for the market, and we'll see what happens with interest rates. In the meantime, I tend to agree with Eric that with the economy as weak as it is, what the Fed is doing right now is probably just testing the waters, and it's unlikely to make any major changes. Of course, we'll know shortly. We're doing this interview prior to the announcement by the FOMC on Wednesday in terms of what the Fed's going to do going forward. The market was looking for clarification. We'll see if that happens. In the meantime, you might want to go by Eric's website, iTulip. Once again, take a look at that article, Hope and Fear. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of one of our Financial Sense premium programs, which are available every week to premium subscribers only. For more information on premium subscriptions, go to our financialsense.com website and click on the subscribe link provided.